Just the other day, I went to buy a Bible, for I had just got saved. When I asked to see a Bible, I could not understand. They had a shelf full 10 feet long, each one a different brand. They had the ASV and the RSV, the Living Bible too. This was so confusing, I didn't know what to do. After about an hour, I still could not decide. They finally had convinced me, and I took the Amplified.
Greetings, listeners. This is the return of the Paleo Protestant podcast. We've been absent for a while. Spring break has intervened, but I am DG Hart, teach history here at Hillsdale College with my colleagues Corey Moss, who also teaches history, and Miles Smith, who also teaches history, if you can believe it. Any reports on spring break to go behind the curtain, if you want to say? I was in Chicago for 3 nights with my wife, and we didn't do a whole lot. I saw a lot of old friends, and they are seriously old. When we went to see a set of friends on the way out of town who were in their 70s, they were the youngest of the bunch. But we had a great time being in the city as usual. That's our custom over spring break.
I had the kids. My wife and one of her brothers flew out to visit her mom and spent, I think, 4 days out there. And just about the minute she walked out the door, I caught a stomach bug. And so made things complicated for a couple of days. But we survived. We survived.
So who was cooking? Who was cooking in your... in your absence?
Well, the oven was
okay.
That is to say, I pulled a pizza out of the box, put it in the oven, and we were good to go. So, typical dad move. Honestly, I probably would have done that even had I not been sick. So kids probably didn't even notice.
And Miles, what did you do?
I just got tires put on my truck. So that was my event. Well, no, that's not true. I helped my former roommate, a Lutheran, a former ecumenical household here in Hillsdale. we had a nice storm here. You guys know this a few weeks back. We went over. We had a random cold day over spring break. It was about 15 degrees in the morning. So our colleague and I chopped a lot of wood and had a big wood pile.
Nice.
Yeah. So. It was good exercise. So,
speaking of temperatures, we are talking today, March 30th, and when I rose this morning, it was 18 degrees here in Hillsdale. But it warmed up. So we're talking today about sort of this springs from our last conversation. We were talking about progressive elements in the LCMS in particular, although we kind of referred back to some other developments in the Presbyterian world. But we talked about whether the degree to which the response to the perceived progressivism was fundamentalist or not. And I think in the comments discussion, Corey, you talked about the LCMS's past with a kind of fundamentalist reputation. So I thought it might be useful for us to talk about confessional Protestantism in relation to fundamentalism, which is also gets into just the general binary world of American white Protestantism, that you have two parties. You have either the evangelicals or the mainline, and the confessional Protestants are usually lumped into the evangelical category, which is really not fair on so many levels. But there is then within the evangelical party, as it were, what evangelicalism sort of begins with fundamentalism going back to the 1920s, at least, when there's an opposition to liberalism in the mainline churches. And that opposition included say, objections to liberal theology over points such as the inerrancy of Scripture, the deity of Christ, the miracles surrounding Christ, the virgin birth, and then some more sort of cultural, political aspects, a lot of attention or worries about evolution. The Scopes trial is sort of like the big emblematic moment of the fundamentalist controversy. But what went with that too was different views of Christ's return, especially some kind of dispensational premillennial view. And so that gets started in the 1920s, that fundamentalists are identified with those aspects and controversies. Evangelicalism starts in the 1940s, at least in the narratives that I've used and followed, and they want to be a kinder, gentler conservatism. They don't want to be fundamentalists, so they want to be nice. One phrase that's often used is a fundamentalist is an evangelical who's mean. Or another one, people sometimes described as evangelical, and this one's getting dated now, but you're an evangelical if you like Billy Graham, mm-hmm. which would mean you're a fundamentalist if you don't like Billy Graham. And there were fundamentalists who opposed Billy Graham, especially in the 1957 New York City, what they used to call crusade, but now revival or awakening. This does bear on our communions. The LCMS had a controversy in the 70s over some of these related matters. The LCMS, as I understand it, also has had some exposure and interest with creation science, which is kind of a further development of opposition to evolution from the 1920s. And then the OPC itself, My Own Communion, comes right out of the 1920s and 1930s. And Miles, dare we say, grew up in the PCA, which comes out of a kind of fundamentalist controversy, the way some would tell it, in the 1970s. But Miles also knows the Anglican world well enough to know whether that they could be called fundamentalists. So that's sort of what we're talking about. And the degree to which confessional Protestants are fundamentalists. One other, I guess, point to make by way of introduction, since Lutherans and Reformed, especially, again, I don't mean to leave the Anglicans out of this, but Lutherans and Reformed can be pretty polemical and pretty particular about doctrine, liturgy, other matters, polity. And that polemicism in the world of nice evangelicals and in the world of tolerant mainline, well, that just looks fundamentalist because it's kind of mean. But the degree to which confessional Protestants tried to hold on to their traditions and are particular about it, that invites outsiders to look at us as fundamentalists. So that's a way of kind of framing this. I don't know which of you would like to go first and comment on this historically, off the cuff remarks.
Well, yeah, I'll dive right in, because there's actually been, I don't want to say a fair bit of literature on this in Lutheran circles, but back in the 60s, I think 1966, a fellow by the name of Milton Rudnick wrote an entire book on fundamentalism and the Missouri Synod. And the way he tells the story is that he went into this research assuming there were real historical connections between the fundamentalism of the fundamentalist modernist controversy and the Missouri Synod. And by the time he put pen to paper and produced the book, he was convinced that that was actually not the case, that there was no influence. I mean, in a couple of ways, he found very little evidence of any communication between representatives of fundamentalism and representatives of the Missouri Synod. I can't remember. It's been some time now. If he made a big deal about views of the millennium, you know, Lutherans historically are millennialist, fundamentalism often associated with a premillennialist position. But then also partly the language barrier, since it's really World War I to a certain extent, but World War II especially, when Lutherans really begin to break out of the German language ghetto. So that's his thesis. A significant caveat and qualification, though, is that he's primarily talking about more or less official representatives of these two traditions, if you want to call them that. And he says that probably there is actually a lot more overlap at the so-called grassroots level. You know, laity, whether they're Lutheran or, you know, fundamentalist Baptists, probably have a lot of the same concerns, and so might be sharing the same sorts of literature on issues like, you know, the inerrancy of scripture. I mean, again, at least where any sort of language barrier wouldn't prevent that, and it probably wouldn't too much, just because we're still doing German in the liturgy and in the Sunday morning service doesn't necessarily mean everybody's speaking it only at home.
I mean, that's just by way of parenthetical comment, it's really quite striking that German language is still the dominant language of the communion for parts of the church, even down to the 1940s. That's admirable in lots of ways. I mean, it's part of the immigrant experience in the United States, in particular form, but that is, you know, once you learn the English language, that's an invitation to enter into the mainstream, whether it be evangelical or mainline. You have to pick sides, perhaps, once you start looking at materials to use in a communion. So, you know, the language barrier could be a real way to maintain your own tradition.
Yeah. There is one of the things that people do point out, though, a lot of the vocabulary of fundamentalism, when it's polemically applied to the LCMS, often goes back to a document produced in the 1930s called the Brief Statement. It's kind of a brief statement of, you know, if you will, sort of the fundamentals of being a Lutheran. And it's been suggested, and I don't know that anybody's tried to do any sort of genealogy, but it's been suggested that document and its concerns are reflective of the same kinds of concerns that the fundamentalists have with liberalism of the 1920s. Mm. We're just a decade behind the times. Mm. And then, of course, the controversy in the 70s that you talk about, again, very, very similar in many respects to the controversy at Princeton, which is probably a more exact analogy, not least because most of the time we're about 40 years behind the times. those are a couple of touch points, yeah.
Well, before Miles weighs in, what percentage, or however you want to qualify it, but do a lot of Lutheran, Missouri Synod Lutherans, avoid the category fundamentalist with some vehemence, or do they care? Is it in the intelligentsia of the church, say, that fundamentalism is a trigger, but for other people, either they're just kind of unaware of the Anglo-American Protestant history, and so that category just doesn't resonate?
That's a good question. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that virtually everyone, clergy and laity alike, rejects the term. Not because they reject necessarily sort of the principles inherent in the fundamentalism, the church historical phenomenon of the 1920s, but they reject it because the only time they have ever heard the word fundamentalism is as a pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
It's the theological equivalent of Neanderthal.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there are positive ways to think about Neanderthals, but nobody ever uses the term that way. So we're certainly not going to refer to ourselves with that term. And I think probably of a large number of Missouri Synod laity aren't even aware of the fundamentalist controversy.
Right. But it would be fresher in their minds because of the Concordia controversy.
Yes.
From the 70s, where the people who left would have been calling the conservatives fundamentalists. And so that language would have resonated.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So that they might think of it through that prism.
Yeah. What do you think, Miles?
Well, so I was Corey's statement that Lutherans are about 40 years behind the times. I think in some ways Anglicans were about 40 years in front of the fundamentalist modernist controversy.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the 1870s, you have the formation of the REC.
Oh, right. Sorry.
And so with George David Cummins. And of course, I would propose, and some of the REC guys may hate me for suggesting this, I think the REC is the fundamentalist wing of the Anglican Communion in North America at any given time for two reasons. One, it's the one that tends to, I think, view itself as most insular. And some of that's good, right? The REC it's kept it at least some identity for a while. But also, I think it is so pegged to the idea of fundamentalism as traditionalism, which I think also maps on to the Presbyterian experience as well. A certain form of traditionalism, be it ecclesiastical, intellectual, whatever you want to call it, is synonymous with fundamentalism. And so in the last 10, 15 years, of course, the REC has become much more high church. It's taken on more Anglo-Catholic trappings. Why? Because Anglo-Catholicism is now sort of traditionalist and fundamentalist in some ways. It's one of the reasons why the continuum has tended to be look more Anglo-Catholic. So what I would propose is that for Anglicans, they miss the actual fundamentalist modernist controversy. I think Lutherans did too. So I think in a lot of ways, the actual controversy itself was litigated maybe more narrowly than we tend to think. But in as much as there's something identifiable as fundamentalism, like an ism that can be kind of co-opted in various communions, Anglicanism had its fundamentalist modernist controversy before Presbyterians and the associated groups with them in the 1920s did, because in as much as Tractarianism is, I would propose, a development of secularism, a sort of responsive development to secularism, that's what the formation of the REC sort of is. It's a response to Anglo-Catholicism. And so I think that although the contours change and sort of the teams might change, in as much as there's fundamentalism in the Anglican Communion, I think that's when you can see it begins, sort of depends on tradition.
And just to add to that, Alan Gelzo, a very gifted historian, and now is known as a historian of Lincoln and the Civil War, but he didn't start out that way. He started out with a good book on Edwards and the New Divinity. That was his dissertation at the University of Pennsylvania. And then he went from there to write a book about the REC, the Reformed Episcopal Church, because Alan at the time was the academic dean and vice president at Reformed Episcopal Seminary. I actually lived in that seminary dorm for a semester while I was finishing up at Westminster and waiting tables in Center City, Philadelphia. So I got to know a little bit about that place. And if I recall, the way he tells that story, there was a guy, faculty member at the seminary who was, I think his name was Rudolph, last name. I can't remember his first name, but he's a Westminster grad and a he adopted the presuppositional apologetics of Van Til, and he's sometimes considered the Van Til of the REC. I have no idea what his influence may be these days, but there was a kind of affinity there between those two Philadelphia institutions, Westminster having started in Philadelphia.
I think the DNA of the REC is centered around in and around Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And it definitely grows in the era that we associate with the fundamentalist modernist controversy. Cummins was from Delaware. So,
you didn't mention the African part of your communion. I mean, and
yeah,
are they considered sometimes to be, because especially of their stand on sexual ethics in particular? Go ahead.
That's a really good question. I think so much of it sort of depends on who's allowed to be a fundamentalist. Like if people who are only sort of reacting against modernism because of the authority of scripture or something like that, if you have this narrow reading of fundamentalism, I don't know if the African bishops are. I mean, they believe scripture is authoritative, but also they are much more open to the gifts, I think, than the first generation of what we call fundamentalists were. And so I think in that sense, it doesn't map precisely on, but certainly on sexual mores, the offices, stuff like that, they certainly fill the kind of description. And they're treated as fundamentalists by the more progressive wing of the Anglophone world. I mean, they are the sort of other, like the fundamentalists for much of the Anglophone. They're also the majority in this case. So
that would be the rare instance where the so-called fundamentalist types are in the majority, because they're almost always in the minority. And this maybe is a segue into the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, which begins in 1936. The Presbyterian phase of the fundamentalist controversy really begins about 1920 over opposition to an ecumenical movement that is proposing a United Church of America, the way that the Canadians formed the United Church of Canada. J. Gresham Machen, biblical scholar at Princeton Seminary, is a commissioner and gets worked up about that and begins to write in Christianity and Liberalism. His most famous book, and a very good book, comes out in 1923. This is the 100th anniversary of that publication. Series of controversies in the church, several of them having to do with Princeton Seminary. Westminster Seminary comes out of that controversy, founded in 1929. And then there's another controversy in the 30s over foreign missions, and Machen's involved in that struggle, and that eventually leads to the formation of the OPC in 1936. So that seems to situate OPC close to the center of fundamentalist developments, but because the OPC was also coming out of old Princeton, and Princeton was very much a reformed confessional school adhering to the Westminster standards, defending Calvinism. One of Machen's quotes from around 1926 is that he never calls himself a fundamentalist. He doesn't like the word. He thinks it's pejorative and narrow. But he said, if I'm forced to choose between fundamentalism and modernism, then I'll call myself a fundamentalist of the greatest character. But I prefer to call myself a Calvinist, is what he said. So there are reasons for distinguishing, aside from the optics, distinguishing Orthodox Presbyterians from fundamentalists. But because the OPC and old Princeton was very polemical, I guess that leads to that question I asked toward the beginning, is that the nature of polemics in our communions and the degree to which that may invite fundamentalist kinds of arguments. And by that could mean something fairly simplistic or, say, ideological, or not maybe as careful as it might be, I'm trying to think of an example in the contemporary moment. I guess one issue would be women's ordination. You can have some pretty crude expressions of that and defenses of complementarianism, but then you can also have some fairly thoughtful defenses of it, as well as arguments that point out the degree to which there are affinities with, if you start to take the Bible in a certain way, that with this issue, it could lead in other directions. And if your church has had controversies over liberalism of some kind, whether it's just mainline Protestant liberalism or Lutheran liberalism or whatever, you can be on the lookout for those kinds of developments all the time, and you want to avoid repeating it. So, I mean, I think the OPC still has a lot of polemics built in it. And we have different outlets for it within the church itself, within the communion, the official organs and agencies. There's much less chance for that to come out on the floor of our assemblies or presbyteries. Commissioners can make arguments that, you know, may sound fundamentalist, but whether that actually is persuasive in the ultimate vote about something, it's sort of like debates in the legislature, say, of the state of Michigan or in Congress. Who knows if people vote on the basis of that? I mean, what you're really voting on is the actual proposal language before you, and that language oftentimes isn't as fundamentalist as people may think it is. But anyway, long-winded way of asking the question of whether there's a polemical side to our communions that points toward fundamentalism.
I'll jump in, and I think the answer is yes, especially in these particular episodes in our history that lead people to associate us with fundamentalism. So, for example, think about the original controversy and the way someone like Fosdick is framing it. So Fosdick is insisting, as a liberal, that...
Just parenthetically, this is, for people who don't know, this is Harry Emerson Fosdick.
Thank you.
Preaches a famous sermon in 1922, Shall the Fundamentalist Win? He's a Baptist in background, but he's preaching in a Presbyterian pulpit, and that kind of really does kick off Presbyterian controversy. But go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and he kind of frames the narrative in a way that says, hey, you know what? We were all getting along fine and recognizing one another as good Christians until certain people tried to squeeze people like me out. So there's an association between fundamentalism and a kind of purging, purification attempt. And that implies that it's the fundamentalists who are making accusations and being unfriendly and being exclusive. And that's certainly the way, for example, that the LCMS controversy in the 70s at our St. Louis Seminary was played out or framed. You know, the conservatives, the confessional guys who retained control of the seminary and the synod, the way they told the story is, hey, we're just doing what we've always done, and these guys are trying to liberalize. But the way they told the story is, no, we're just doing what we've always done. These guys are becoming fundamentalist and no longer have room for us, and they're trying to push us out. This is part of the story that you see in the books published about the controversy. I think, I don't know if it's the most recent, but James Berkey's book, Power, Politics, and the Missouri Synod, 2010, 2011, he tells the story very much from the perspective of the seminary president, the synodical president, excuse me, and others were leading the synod in a fundamentalist direction, and that involved polemic accusations and a kind of purge of guys who were garden variety traditional LCMS types.
Hmm.
So I think one of the things I wonder about is the kind of explosion of what we'll call evangelicalism and the growth of the Sun Belt, meaning the sort of contemporaneous growth of evangelicalism. Fundamentalism has kind of been retroactively applied within the Anglican Communion. So there are things that in modern Anglican discourse, you bring up the complementarian versus egalitarian controversy, Daryl. There is language applied to that now as fundamentalism versus whatever fundamentalism is now currently sort of fighting against. What's interesting is there are people who kind of reflexively would say, well, sure, if you're considering a hard view of gender in the offices as fundamentalists, I'm a fundamentalist. And so what you'll find is even some Anglo-Catholics will sort of say, well, yeah, I'm a fundamentalist. And I think what the reason that is because they don't have the investment of history with the actual fundamentalist modernist controversy. They're not particularly bothered because for what it means for so many of them, it's just traditionalist or some sort of traditionalist conservatism. And so I think that one of the interesting things is fundamentalism, I think within Presbyterian and I suppose Baptist circles too, is attached to a hermeneutical debate. And I think that retroactively, as it's applied to other groups, that's not necessarily what's going on. So they don't, like Anglicans today who are traditionalists, if you were to call a lot of them fundamentalists, they would be like, okay, fine. I mean, so it has a much less precise taxonomy. I think it's just a generalized slander that at least conservatives are sort of like, well, yeah, whatever. I guess I'm a fundamentalist and I'm a, those traditionalists and fundamentalists are really synonymous to a considerable degree. In Anglicanism, in a way they're not, I don't think, in other communions.
So on that point, though, too, on Anglicans, do you think the Episcopal Church looks at ACNA as fundamentalist?
Yeah.
And how does that affect ACNA's presentation of itself? And then going with that, then you have the other side of it. The Episcopalians may view ACNA a certain way, but then evangelicals in search of more tradition or liturgy or something look at ACNA as this great home. And so you have the arrival of a lot of, I'll just say Wheaton,
right,
Illinois, whether it's Christianity Today or Wheaton College types who go in there with the nice Protestantism and could make it squishy in ways congenial in some ways to the Episcopalians. But so what's that dynamic like?
So they're pretty obviously doing sort of religious sociology by coming in. It's not theological. Like, so someone like Beth Moore, I don't know what the hell Beth Moore believes, but she hasn't become an Anglican because she's really like, she's dived into the prayer book. And now is like convinced that the ordinals are authoritative or convinced that the formularies are authoritative. Like, so I think that Anglicanism's weakness is that it's not as polemical as it should be. This is Gerald Bray's complaint.
Right.
And I think he's right on that. The Episcopal Church clearly views any religion to its right as fundamentalist these days. So I think if the perception of the Episcopal Church, thankfully, is mattering less and less and less, especially as the Episcopal Church itself kind of is withering. I think the debates within what you can call conservative Protestantism are more interesting because they affect us more. I think precisely because of what you're saying, there's a lot of people who would come into Anglo-Catholic dioceses precisely because they want to be traditionalist and quote unquote fundamentalist, if you want to use that term. And these are the folks who, these are the folks that the women wear head coverings and Anglican services. You have kind of
wow.
Like the almost, very traditional, liturgy, very traditional communion practices, guys celebrating Ad Orientem and stuff like that. So sort of the depths of Anglo-Catholicism is
big families.
Yeah, big families, right? Like, so this is a fundamentalist, quote unquote, pursuit, right?
Right.
Whereas you have other evangelicals who are claiming, and it's usually almost overwhelmingly a response to the Southern Baptist Church.
Hmm.
Like almost all, like look at all these famous people that have come into ACNA. And I mean, basically for them, they're not doing Anglicanism. They're just Baptist in drag, right? Like they I mean, that's a joke my rector and I have, but like, it's kind of true, right? Like on some level, like there's this perception that we are escaping fundamentalism to be Anglican now, and which is a completely different taxonomy than anybody who studies it would understand. So I think that for Anglicanism is kind of this all things to all people reality, and fundamentalism, I think this is where I would press even scholars of fundamentalism. Like, fundamentalism is a term that now means all things to all people. I forget who was it who said that a fundamentalist is the ignorant son of a bitch to my right. Like what? Like who? Like that, who was it? I think a pretty well-known scholar kind of was jokingly saying this is what it means now.
Yep.
Right. And so, like, fundamentalism as a meaningful intellectual label, I don't think exists much anymore. Certainly not one that tracks with the generation of people from the 1920s. When we talk about fundamentalism, yeah, for Anglicans, it's kind of this catch-all. Yeah, I guess we're fundamentalists because we're to the left or to the right of TC. I guess we're not in some ways because Baptist or sociologically disaffected, never Trump Baptists, you know, whatever it is. So fundamentalism, I think, has applied to Anglicans in a lot of ways that aren't inconsistent with other communions. It's almost all of the ways it's used for everybody else could apply to us. So
I think this is interesting. Your comment about, you know, Anglo-Catholic types might consider themselves fundamentalists because of the commitment to tradition. And I think sociologically, at least in the Missouri Synod, this is probably one of the reasons we keep the term at arm's length, is because we associate fundamentalism with anti-liturgicalism.
Hmm.
And maybe even to a certain extent, you know, the stereotype of uneducated, at least, you know, in terms of the education of the clergy. And so when we hear the word fundamentalist, we automatically think sort of low church, you know, floppy leather Bible, stalking the front of the church. He's not in vestments. He's not standing behind the pulpit following a script. And so even if, you know, theologically, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think, I mean, to go back to the categories of the 1920s, do you affirm the deity of Christ? Do you think that scripture is actually inspired by God and infallible? Yes. Oh, then you're a fundamentalist. Oh, okay. Well, if that's all that fundamentalist means, then yeah, count me in. But we tend to think sociologically, I think, very often.
And it's also curious that, though, that say the people coming into your communion, I suspect there aren't a lot of fundamentalist types, people coming out of the charismatic evangelical worlds into the LCMS, again, because of an ethnic and previous language barrier, that Lutheranism, I will still contend, and I don't mean to give any offense, is a kind of other in American Protestantism.
Yep.
But the OPC gets people coming in from charismatic Pentecostal backgrounds. And, you know, used to be the case, I've heard some older Orthodox Presbyterians say something like, well, we don't want to talk about being Presbyterian. We don't talk about evangelical, because for people who know the word Presbyterian, they're thinking the mainline church. So they want to play down that. On the other side, though, people who want more substance than what they're getting and say, garden variety, charismatic, Pentecostal. They've sort of read some R.C. Sproul, or they've gotten to know some doctrine. Well, the OPC has that stuff. And boy, are they going to get it good and hard if they're ministers, because to pass ordination exams, you know, you've really got to do a lot of homework. Not to mention then, if you are a pastor again, you've got to really bone up on church polity, because you're going to have to follow those rules both in your home session, with meetings with elders, and then Presbyterian General Assembly. So, you know, it's not for the faint-hearted that you go into the OPC, even if you think, oh, good, I'm getting something really conservative. It's not going to be easy. Wow. You going to say something, Miles?
Yeah. So I like Corey's point, I think, about the way fundamentalism is talked about anti-liturgical, I think is interesting, because I think the same reflex is common in Anglicanism, even while people who are sociologically fundamentalists become Anglicans. Hmm. But they leave the sociological definer, right? Because they have a tradition and they have liturgy and they have all that now, even as they're carrying similar sociological commitments from fundamentalism. Think about, you know, the way the family is litigated in evangelicalism or in fundamentalism, stuff like that. Even as they're carrying at least some of those dispositions into a particular Anglican diocese. So I think what's kind of interesting is, yeah, they don't become Lutherans. They do become Anglicans, though. Mm. There's a lot of ex-Pentecostals, a lot of ex-fundamentalists who are in the Anglican Church. I think because of the same dispositions that kind of searcher mentality, right? The search for the truth. And well, now, you know, we have a liturgy now, so we're kind of heading towards there. So I think that a lot of them would become LCMS if the LCMS was open communion.
Right.
That we get a lot of Anglicans get a lot of potential Lutherans because, quite frankly, we're a much cheaper date as far as commitment of time and commitment of, you know, catechetical time and whatnot. So I think that the LCM, it is an other, but I mean, if there wasn't anybody who did any research and found out the LCMS is closed communion, my guess is they would receive the same type of searching fundamentalists as Anglicans do.
Can I throw one more thing in? I don't know if you got a direction you want to go, but I wonder, and both of you know in the American scene will know this much better than me, but is there a sense in which people who use the term fundamentalist kind of bake into their understanding of fundamentalism a bleeding of religion into politics? So Daryl, you mentioned the Scopes trial, and I think a lot of people hear fundamentalism, they think Scopes trial, and so they associate fundamentalism with, you know, sort of swerving out of its lane and getting involved in politics maybe the way churches shouldn't. Am I off base here? Is some political involvement part of, at least maybe implicitly, thinking about fundamentalism?
Jones and that, like, there's a certain quiet I think of people associating with fundamentalism historically.
Okay.
Like, but Daryl probably can speak more to the broad array, but like in the South, at least fundamentalists are kind of quietists. So.
Okay.
But I mean, Machen's ally and then nemesis, Carl McIntyre, was, and there was a split in the OPC a year into our history where the Bible Presbyterians left, led by Carl McIntyre, because, dispensationalism, alcohol, whether the church should take a stand on that. This was just after Prohibition, obviously. Some other matters related to the ethnic composition of Westminster Seminary faculty. But McIntyre was one of the fiercest, most fierce anti-communists of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and had great sway. And I think, you know, partly responsible for that perception that you're mentioning, Corey, down to say, and this may be before both of your time either in the academy or in paying attention to the world, going back to how young you are, Miles, but roughly 1990 or so, late 80s, Martin Marty, the dean of church historians in the United States, longtime church historian at University of Chicago, started a series on a big 4 or 5 volume series on fundamentalism, global fundamentalism. But part of the kicker of this was how much Muslims, the troubles in Ireland, you know, various groups, wasn't just Protestants, who had political outlets, whether good kind of legitimate politics or bad kind terrorists. But there was certainly a sense that fundamentalism stood for that kind of threat to a liberal order of some kind. Now that's faded. But at the time, that was a big project. It was even sponsored in part by the American Council of Learned Societies, which is a pretty big imprimatur. So again, that's faded, but it does relate to something else I wanted to talk about. I mean, so many of the televangelists, so-called TV preachers back then, Jerry Falwell among them, the founding president of the of Moral Majority. You know, I'm curious the degree to which people in our communions, confessional Protestant lay people, but also officers, listen to radio, watch television broadcasts by either evangelicals or fundamentalists. And again, because of what, Cora, you've been saying about a kind of barrier between Lutheranism and the broader Protestant world, is there more reluctance, for whatever reason, among Lutherans to turn on the radio and listen to the ordinary preacher you're here on one of the Christian radio networks?
Yeah. I suspect there is. And I suspect that it's partly been baked into them by Lutheran upbringing. I mean, honestly, until relatively recently, there would have been no need to. If you wanted to listen to preaching on the radio, you would listen to the Lutheran Hour, and the, you know, the KFUO radio station that originally broadcast that, you know, the longest continually operating Christian broadcast station in the United States. And so, I mean, there's a sense of pride that, hey, you know what? We're not 40 years behind the curve on this one. We actually got in on the ground floor of religious radio. And so from day one, if we want to listen to religious radio, we've got our guy that we can listen to. I don't know, but I mean, as you were speaking, what I of course thought of is you mentioned some of the young earth creation science stuff.
Right.
And someone like Ken Ham, I don't know if he would self-identify as a fundamentalist. I think most people would think of Ken Ham as a fundamentalist. Lot of LCMS laity, I believe, read Ken Ham and his outfit's publications. I don't know the extent to which this is encouraged by clergy or frowned upon by clergy, but it lends some credence to well, I mean, kind of where we began, the idea that there is a, you know, perhaps a possibility that in the 1930s, even Lutherans are kind of watching the fundamentalists and see them as allies, and so maybe borrowing some of their stuff. If it's happening now, maybe it was happening then.
And for Anglicans, Miles, I could imagine, I mean, going to your sociological point, which relates to education, that you get a higher brow Protestant, and they may not be as inclined to listen to Christian radio as they would be to NPR.
Well, that's probably true, but in some ways, I think a lot of them were formed by Christian radio. So many people in ACNA did not begin their lives an ACNA. And so I think so many, you know, Anglican communicants are people who have been formed effectively as evangelicals, and their Anglicanism is a reaction to it. So in some ways, I mean, it's holistic. I mean, they are still evangelical. They're just really mad about it. And so they're going to go, right, their rebellion is Anglicanism or something like that. And I think this is why in so many ways, if you talk to modern Anglicans, they're pretty proficient in all that. I mean, what's funny is I grew up in the PCA. My parents did not listen to Christian radio that much. So I think the PCA maps on to evangelical and even fundamentalist far more than ACNA does in a lot of ways. And yet I know less about Christian culture than a lot of, you know, high church Anglicans who have come from fundamentalist societies. So, or fundamentalist societies, churches, whatever you want to call them. And so I think there's, there may not be interest in it, but there's certainly proficiency in the kind of fundamentalist language of so much of American religion.
There's evangelical rather than fundamentalist, but something like Christianity Today. And I don't really know any LCMS clergy who read or subscribe to Christianity Today. I mean, not necessarily because they disagree with what they would find there, but I don't think there's a real interest. And I would say the same thing of LCMS Laity. They get their synodical magazine once a month, and just don't feel, for good or ill, don't feel like they need to dip their toes in other waters. So I wonder if something like that holds with radio and television. It's not that they're avoiding it because they know it's bad for them. It's just that they're not interested.
Right. And don't think about it.
Yeah.
Well, we probably should wrap this up. It's getting later in the day here. But thanks. I couldn't find good copy for a sponsor. I was hoping to use some big pharma company. Ann and I just finished watching Dope Sick on Hulu, which is kind of annoying, but also really pretty good. And that dovetails with the CCA here on campus on big pharma, which, kind of spooked me. Robert Kennedy Jr. was one of the speakers, and, listeners may not be all that interested in this, but I had trouble persuading my students in American Heritage, freshmen and sophomores, that the Kennedy family was a big deal once upon a time. And and I think maybe only two of my students knew that Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Sr., had been assassinated.
Oh, wow.
For the boomer generation, those of us who are alive in 1968, following up on the Martin Luther King Jr., JFK assassinations, that was a bad time. So to have him here, but his talk on Big Pharma was actually pretty good. And so it's on my mind, but I couldn't find a good ad copy. In fact, I was even in Philadelphia over break with a good friend, an Orthodox Presbyterian, at a family meal, and he works for Pfizer. I was giving him a hard time about working for the beast, but so I think we're out of time, out of subjects. We will return. We've got I think we're going to have a guest on one of our future recordings talk about Protestant intellectual life, but I won't give that away until we get the guest nailed down. Anyone want to say any concluding word before I close?
I got nothing.
No. All right. All right. Thanks, gents. Thanks, listeners. We'll do this again relatively soon, God willing.
Right. Bye-bye. Thanks, Daryl. Take care.
So I took the modern version and I started going to church. There was one nearby called Baptist, and I really didn't have to search. But when the preacher started reading, the words did not match up. But the subject of that morning was Bibles that are corrupt. He explained about words changed, words missing, and verses missing too, and how this affects church doctrines, what we believe and do. He said it all started with the devil in Genesis chapter 3. He changed God's word when speaking to Eve. The rest is history. So I went back to the bookstore to get me a KJV. They looked at me like I was crazy when I explained to them, you see, God wrote only one book and it has no copyright. The others are not holy Bibles, and for this truth I'll fight. My pastor just taught about this fact, and it's very clear to me. We need a final authority, and it's found in the KJV. And if later I want to paraphrase, I might consider it then. But for now I'm just satisfied with the real Bible and an extra large grin. So if you go to buy a Bible, please take this good advice. Take nothing but the old King James, the others may sound nice. Compared to the new translations, old King James may seem odd, but the difference is expected when you have the Word of God.